The typical course features 3 50-minute lectures per week. A pattern is usually quickly established in which the professor repeatedly fills the blackboard with equations, copying from handwritten notes, while the students try to copy each boardful into their own notes before it is erased to make room for the next. Professors usually tell their classes to feel free to ask questions, but their rushed answers quickly convey a different message, that questions impede their race to present the voluminous notes in the allotted time. Hence, after the first 2 or 3 lectures, students ask few questions, and those are usually minor points of clarification. Shouldn't that be a minus sign, or is that theta squared in the numerator? To the amusement of people passing by the classroom and glancing in, professors stick to this formal lecture pattern even when there are only 1 or 2 students enrolled in or attending the class. Students eager to develop their physical intuition see such small group lectures as missed opportunities for truly educational discussion. On the other hand, members of the cult of fact and formula see no absurdity even in the one-on-one lecture. Like any other lecture, it supplies the listener with an uninterrupted flow of valuable facts and figures. The homework usually consists of the professor's selection of problems from those appearing at the end of the chapters in the textbook. The assignments are made every week or two in each class and can be very demanding. On nights before class meetings at which homework is due, problem-solving sessions often run into the early morning or even pre-dawn hours, the only break being a food run to a nearby candy machine or junk food outlet. It is not unusual for students to miss the class itself while finishing up the assignment or fall asleep during the lecture. A final exam in every course marks the end of each semester. The exams are like the homework, more problems to solve. In fact, the exam problems are often very similar or even identical to homework problems. The exam is typically either a 2-hour in-class test or a take-home test for which students may have up to a few days. While the take-home test may be pedagogically superior, it is nevertheless a grueling experience for the student. From the minute the test is handed out until the minute it is due, the student is engaged in a marathon-style effort. The fact that near-perfect papers will be competing against each other keeps the pressure high and adds to the repulsiveness of the experience. Finally, the professor assigns each student a grade, usually an A or B. By graduate school convention, anything less indicates failure. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. I'm reading from Chapter 8, Narrowing the Political Spectrum. And you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. And continuing with the next subsection titled Qualification. A bachelor's degree in physics, admission to physics graduate school, and A's and B's in the graduate physics courses do not qualify a student to complete the work for the professional degree in physics. About half of those admitted will be eliminated before PhDs are handed out. And most of this weeding out occurs around a formal process of qualification, in which the student is either passed on for a special test or is expelled from the university. In Chapter 2, I discuss the reason the system takes professional qualification so seriously. Seriously enough in this case to expel many advanced students. Professional work is politically sensitive and so requires an individual who has not just a working knowledge of the dominant paradigms of the field, but also a willingness and ability to hold on to the attitude deemed proper for the position. This attitudinal discipline is measured in part by the discipline the student is willing to bring to assigned work, for such discipline is ultimately ideological. Courses are not sufficiently reliable as a measure of this discipline. They can succeed in their most obvious goal, giving students a working knowledge of the dominant paradigms of a field, yet leave incomplete their goal of producing people who will maintain the desired discipline on assigned work. Moreover, a course grade can sometimes be no more than what it claims to be, a measure of subject matter learned, and is therefore not a reliable measure of properly disciplined work style. This creates the need to take the students who have already passed the courses and examine them again with a qualifying examination. This massive test-to-end-all tests is not primarily concerned with measuring the basic subject matter learned in the courses. The courses themselves have already measured that. It functions as more of a measure of commitment to a particular work style. At the University of California, Irvine, the physics department administers its physics qualifying examination once a year, just before classes begin in the fall. The rules limit the student to only 2 attempts, and the faculty may discourage particular students from even trying it a second time. The student is, quote, free to choose what year to take the test, but he must weigh his level of preparation against the increasing number of years he is gambling on his attempt to pass. Most take the test after spending at least 2 years as a graduate student. The prospect of failing the qualifying test frightens the student, even the student who is the best at answering the kind of questions used on the test. The student is frightened because his desired future as a professional in his field of interest is at stake, but he is also frightened because society does not guarantee his material security, except at a life-shortening subsistence level. It seems possible for the individual, if suddenly of no value to employers, to go overnight from a job to walking the streets, from being somebody to being nobody, from living in the suburbs to living on Skid Row, left to suffer and struggle for survival among the desperate at the bottom of society. It doesn't matter much that such individual downfall is very unlikely. By simply featuring the possibility, the system announces the fundamental insecurity of the individual. This insecurity unrelentingly haunts the student studying for the qualifying test. The student sees professional training as his chance for a secure future, with status and non-alienating work, his chance for a life free from the threat of a nightmarish trip to the bottom of the heap. An important chunk of his past is also riding on the qualifying test, because no matter how many years he has invested in preparation, coming close to passing is worth nothing in terms of attaining professional status. The years of preparation go down the drain along with the hoped-for career. The qualification system is especially terrorizing for the working-class student, whose security depends so strongly on his value to employers. The working-class student who sees himself as upwardly mobile feels that he has farther to fall, with opportunity unlikely to knock a second time. This disparity in pressure is fine with the system, because working-class students need more adjustment anyway. If the student acts like the qualifying exam is a life-and-death issue, he does so to the extent that he feels that his ultimate socioeconomic status is at stake. One consistently finds the most terrorized students doing the most work in research lab jobs, working the longest hours. What others consider shit work, they have to see as a great opportunity. And so they are the ones who end up doing it. This is another example of the university's tendency to transmute social hierarchies into academic hierarchies. The graduate student who isn't passed on the qualifying test is barred from registering for classes and is fired from his job as a teaching assistant, regardless of his job performance. His office and desk are quickly assigned to someone else. Overnight, he has become a mere visitor in the place where he had been spending most of his waking hours working and studying. His presence is suddenly very awkward, a downbeat reminder of what can be done to anyone. He gets the same kind of overly nice and overly cold treatment that people give to cancer victims. Very soon, he goes away. His name itself strikes an unhappy note and so isn't mentioned much by those with whom he spent so much time. He is a non-person. The possibility of being failed on the test scares the student for another reason: humiliation in front of family and friends. What can the student say about literally flunking out of a subject after studying it for 6 or 7 years or more? The threat of missing out on a career as a professional in his field of interest, of losing the years he has wagered on such a career, of immediate unemployment and non-person status, of humiliation as a flunk-out, these threats terrorize the student. If the student is not part of an independent organization that can analyze what is going on and raise a defense if necessary, then he may adjust his ideology to that of those with power over him when he senses that doing so will increase his chances of survival. He would make this adjustment not because he is a weak individual, but because individuals are weak. The unorganized student, like the victim of cult indoctrination or a deprogramming attempt, is caught alone. Studying for the qualifying test is an intense process, consisting almost entirely of working problems. Students get the bulk of their practice problems from old qualifying exams. These problems and their solutions are like catechisms in that they are fairly well known but not easily learned. Beginning with the student's first day in graduate school, the fraction of his effort in physics that he devotes specifically to passing the examination increases. For most students, this fraction reaches 100% months before the exam. However, the intensity of the studying usually increases beyond this measure. Test preparation, having become 100% of the student's effort in physics, expands even further until it constitutes 100% of the student's life effort. Except during the valuable hours, minutes, and seconds reluctantly rationed out to such necessities as sleeping, eating, and defecating, the student anxiously readies himself for the test. Although study schedules vary, the student typically awakens in the morning, eats a quick breakfast, and resumes his problem-solving work. 12 hours later that night, we find him still studying, having taken breaks only to eat and only when he could not concentrate. Late at night, if he is physically incapable of further concentration, he crashes. If, however, he can continue, he may feel that he must, in which case he may work far into the early morning hours. He is keenly aware that these are not extra hours. He will get a later start the next day. Weekends are merely another 48 hours to study. The intensity of the work during this period is ominous. It sets a precedent for later work on a professional job. Indeed, any accommodation that the student makes in attitude or ideology while preparing for the test will be in the direction of those who command the large amount of social power necessary to extract such a marathon effort from the student. One indication of the pressure on the student is the physical and mental toll that the preparation process takes. While I was at UCI, for example, a physics graduate student suffered permanent loss of most sight in one eye after he went through the stress of weeks of intense study for his second bout with the test. He paid a high price to be passed. Another student freaked out in the weeks before his second encounter with the test. He was not passed. Such effects go beyond the students themselves to their families. Students have no choice but to, in effect, cut themselves off from their partners and children for some months before the test. Those who are failed on the test, of course, have their problems exacerbated and have the hardest time convincing themselves that it was worth it. The test itself is typically a week-long ordeal of examination. On Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of test week at UCI, for example, the physics graduate student goes through a gauntlet of morning and afternoon sessions of written examinations on various physics subtopics. After this barrage of 7 written examinations, the student stands alone before a committee of 3 faculty members for a 2-hour oral examination. This takes place on Thursday or Friday, and each student is assigned a different committee. Members of the committee typically ask problem-type questions, and the student answers using the blackboard. At the end of the week, the entire physics faculty gathers in a closed meeting to decide the fate of the students. Strange as it may seem, in most physics departments, a student's score on the test is only one factor in the faculty's decision as to whether or not the student has passed the test. Students are not usually told their scores. This gives faculty members the option of deciding that a student has failed the test, even if the student has outscored someone they are going to pass. In arriving at their personal opinions on whether to pass or fail a student, individual faculty members consider anything and everything they know or think they know about that student, including impressions carried away from informal discussions with the student and with others around the department. A faculty member who talks informally with a student in the hallway or at the weekly after-colloquium reception inevitably comes away with a feeling about whether or not that student thinks like a physicist. The student's political outlook can easily make a difference in the faculty member's assessment. For example, in the usual informal discussion of an issue in the news, the student who rails against technical incompetence and confines his thoughts to the search for technical solutions within the given political framework builds a much more credible image as a professional physicist than does the student who emphasizes the need to alter the political framework as part of the solution. Indeed, the latter approach falls outside the work assignments given to professional physicists in industry and academe, and so represents thinking unlike a physicist's. When everything else is equal, the student who is known around the department has the advantage of personal relationships with faculty members. Disadvantaged once again is the part-time student or the student who must work off campus. These students are not seen much in the halls, in the student and faculty offices, or at the colloquia or at the teas. The image of these students as part of the physics community is apt to be weak when the faculty decides on qualification. Anxiety runs high at the faculty meeting. Most faculty are perfectly comfortable with an authoritarian system that dictates who passes and who fails, especially a rationalized authoritarian system in which the scores, not the professors, do the dictating. However, with its consideration and evaluation of all aspects of the candidate's life, the authoritarian system has its totalitarian moment, and at that moment it passes final judgment on the career plans of the individual. Some faculty feel overexposed taking such a direct hand in the process. Sometimes the result is much discussion and debate about who to pass and who to fail, especially if the test scores don't match the preferences of all the faculty members. The magic of the test, though, is that such conflict usually doesn't arise. The decision indicated to the faculty by non-physics considerations, such as attitude, almost always agrees with the decision that would have been reached by consideration of the test score alone. That is, the student who has an outlook that the faculty doesn't like and whom the faculty does not want to pass, usually, but not always, gets lower test scores than those the faculty wants to pass. A master's degree is almost always given to those who are not passed on the exam. This degree is not highly regarded by the faculty or students at PhD granting institutions, and is readily tossed out as a consolation prize for those who are to be discouraged from going on, to use the words of the National Academy of Sciences. The master's degree, and sometimes the offer to let the student take the test another time, is given to cool out the student. It also serves to console the consciences of the faculty who kicked the student out. Those who are not passed on their second encounter with the test don't get a second booby prize, just a kick in the butt. It is hard to forget scenes involving these victims of the qualification system. Bill E., near his desk, packing his books and papers into boxes after freezing up during the test. Tom B.'s wife rushing down the hall behind her husband to a professor's office in outraged disbelief that Tom had been failed for the last time, as if it were some sort of horrible mistake, running as if toward murderers standing over her husband's body. The qualification system clearly has a permanent effect on the lives of those it weeds out. But does the process of qualification have a permanent effect on students who qualify? The answer to this question is no for some students and yes for others. The student who is detached from the subject in which he is majoring, for example, the student who has chosen his major mainly because it is the subject offering the highest income and status potential of all the subjects in which he thinks he could succeed, sees qualification as just another hurdle to be vaulted, just some more prescribed alienated labor, and is little affected by doing this work. By alienated labor, I mean work that the individual wouldn't do if he didn't have to. Such work is not intrinsically satisfying but serves the interests of someone else. Today the educator, who is producing trained people, tomorrow the employer, who owns the product of the laborer's work. The sign of non-alienated labor is the disappearance of the distinction between work and play for the individual doing it. Non-alienated labor is usually more intense than alienated labor. However, the student who loves the subject and is not alienated from it is profoundly affected by the qualification process. The process of preparing for the qualifying test, because of the kind of questions on the test and the way they must be answered, tragically alienates this student from his or her own field of interest. The test emphasizes quick recall, memorized tricks, work on problem fragments, work under time pressure, endurance, quantitative results, comfort with confinement to details, comfort with a particular social framework, comfort with a hierarchical division of labor, and so on. And it de-emphasizes physical insight, qualitative discussion, exploration, curiosity, creativity, history, philosophy, and so on. This forces the student who wants to be passed to adopt an industrial view of the subject, to view it as an instrument of production, to use it in an alienated way. The next two chapters look in greater detail at how the test's format and questions alienate the student from the subject. Because few careers in physics can be pursued outside one or another institutions, students who, for love or money, want careers in physics must obtain the credentials that the employing institutions demand. Students in this bind have little choice but to plunge into the intense and protracted test preparation process. The lovers of physics insist to themselves that the alienated labor involved is just temporary, that it is just to get over a hurdle beyond which lies the opportunity to do physics the way it is supposed to be done. Everyone has had the experience of being motivated by interest to work on a hobby or project with great dedication and perseverance. To prepare adequately for the qualifying test, the individual must maintain this kind of discipline on the practice problems for a seemingly unending period of time. Motivated, however, not by his interest in old exam problems, but by his desire to be allowed to pursue his interests in the subject. Hence, even if the student finds some of the practice problems interesting, the preparation process sets the stage for his alienation from the subject. For he labors on the practice problems because he is under threat of expulsion, and he labors on them not in a satisfying way, but hurriedly, because of the large number of problems he must cover. The exam ends not only hundreds of hours of explicit preparation, but also thousands of hours of indirect preparation. Courses taken, work done, and problems discussed with the test in the back of the student's mind. Students should not cavalierly label their alienated labor as merely temporary, as instrumental to get the degree, but easily reversed afterwards. Performing intense alienated labor for an extended period of time changes the student. It dampens his creativity and curiosity, clouds his memory of his original interests and ideas, and weakens his resolve to pursue them, while getting him used to doing protracted disciplined labor on assigned problems. It is empty rhetoric to tell the student who has gone through the qualification process that he is free now to pursue his career's original goals, for he is now a different person. What the student thought was a temporary concession to the system, I'll play along just enough so that I can get what I want from the system, turns out to be the beginning of a forced permanent adjustment to the system. The alienated work that the student did to prepare for the qualifying exam, work that was merely to assure his future, is his future. It may seem strange that the student has to demonstrate his willingness and ability to perform alienated labor in his subject of interest to be allowed a career in that subject. However, from one point of view, this requirement is appropriate, because a certain amount of alienation makes the student better able to stomach most jobs in his field, which require disciplined work on assigned problems. The qualifying exam measures the student's willingness and ability to lead such an employer-oriented work life. Being passed on the qualifying test is less a politically neutral mark of intellectual achievement or self-discipline than it is a demonstration to future employers of a readiness to play by the rules at work. In practical terms, being passed on the professional qualifying exam means being permitted to begin a kind of apprenticeship, the nature of which depends upon the field. During this apprenticeship, the professional-to-be learns more technical skills, but the main lessons are on the protocols, communication skills, and organizational skills that the professional uses to practice the tricks of the trade. Although these skills vary from one profession to another, they typically include how to organize a work project, deal with clients, write reports, make presentations at professional meetings, and delegate work to assistants and secretaries. The student who has been passed on the qualifying examination is a bit like the son of the chairman of the board of a corporation who has been given a job in the mailroom. The son differs from other workers in the mailroom in that he is on the track to an executive position, as everyone in the company knows without being told. Similarly, those passed on a qualifying examination are not yet professionals, but there is little doubt that it is just a matter of time before they will be. The institution that examined them has agreed in principle to make them professionals. There is usually no doubt that the student can learn the technical and non-technical skills that he or she is expected to pick up after the qualifying exam, even though doing so may require many hours of hard work. The student already has the most crucial qualities of the professional. Those who staff the training institutions certainly act in accord with this view. Students who are passed on the exam often report an abrupt and bewildering improvement in the way they are treated by faculty members and others. As professionals in principle, they are already junior members of the club. And I'm reading from Chapter 8 of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. The title of this chapter is Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Going on to the next subsection titled Research. The graduate student who qualifies must do one more thing to get the degree. work on a multi-year research project under the supervision of a faculty member. Whether the student works on a self-contained research problem or on a problem that is just one part of a large research project, the years of work serve to induct him into a particular field and get him accustomed to doing research in the standard way. The nature of the student's research problem, the way the student gets the problem, and the way the student works on the problem are all reminiscent of industrial research. First, the problem is usually narrow and of little general intellectual interest. Second, the student rarely develops the problem himself. Instead, he chooses his research topic from the problems that faculty members are planning to work on. The professor who supplies the problem, which is usually very similar to problems on which the professor and his previous graduate students have done extensive work, becomes the student's dissertation advisor. Third, the student will toil on this problem 50, 60 or more hours per week for 4, 5, 6 or more years, doing work that is more often tedious than not. Much of the creative part of the work is done by the student's advisor, who is often the student's employer as well, during meetings with the student. At these meetings, which are often weekly, but which may be daily if the professor employer is a slave driver type, the student gets instructions on what to do next, usually called suggestions. In scientific fields, these are typically ideas about what to modify in a calculation, a computer program, an electronic system, or whatever. The student goes off, tries to get it to work, and reports the results at the next meeting. The choice of a research topic is particularly important for students headed for university jobs. More often than those who get jobs in industry, these students end up spending their entire careers working in the same subfield that their graduate student research topic came from, and often on closely related topics within that subfield. Even when every professor and research group in the department is willing to take on a particular student to work on an available problem, that student is far from free to choose one of the available problems. Subfields vary widely in the financial support available for graduate students, in job prospects after graduation, and in the number of years it takes to get the degree, and in the general intellectual interest of the problems addressed. Because of these differences, the student's socioeconomic class and cultural background play an important role in his choice of subfield and topic within that subfield. Students from more secure backgrounds exercise freer choices, and students from less secure backgrounds are more subject to the channeling of curiosity and career that was described in chapters 4 and 5. The less secure students are driven into subfields that offer immediate and continuing financial support. This support usually takes the form of a research assistantship, in which the student's advisor or group leader hires the student to assist in a research project, using money from a federal contract or grant issued for that work. The research problem that the student has been given is a part of that work. So, from the student's point of view, the student is hired to work on his own research project. Most students would rather be a research assistant than a teaching assistant, so as to devote more time to their research and thereby graduate sooner. Well-funded subfields offer more and more secure research assistantships. Secure assistantships are not going to expire after a year or two when a one-time grant runs out. They come from groups with ongoing government research contracts or multiple research grants that are regularly renewed. Hence, students tend to develop a special intellectual interest in well-funded subfields. In fact, students find the research problems in these subfields doubly interesting because subfields that are well-funded at the university are usually the ones that offer the best job prospects after graduation. University research in these subfields is funded so heavily because the subfields are areas of heavy commercial or military activity. Students know that job prospects vary greatly by subfield and are well aware of which subfields the marketplace has deemed hot. Thus, 27 physics graduate students take an interest in condensed matter physics, the basis of electronic devices, for everyone who takes an interest in acoustics, and 30 take an interest in nuclear physics for everyone who takes an interest in geophysics. Also, at a given school, it often takes many more years to get a PhD in some subfields than others. Students from less secure backgrounds are more likely to choose one of the quicker subfields, or at least one of the surer research problems, even though such a problem is also certain to be more routine and of less general intellectual interest. A significant number of graduate students now get their research training by participating in large research projects in which the work is organized in a way that matches the industrial model even more closely. As industrial research has become more and more specialized, university research, too, has tended toward a focus on narrower problems and to increasing division of labor in the pursuit of those problems. The ever finer division of labor is particularly apparent in subfields where experiments are undertaken by large university research groups or by collaborations of research groups from many institutions. In particle physics, for example, accelerator laboratories such as CERN near Geneva, Switzerland, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois near Chicago, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in Stanford, California, now play host to collaborations that bring together hundreds of physicists for a single experiment. Such experiments can span a decade from the overall planning and the design, construction, and testing of the particle detectors to the collection and analysis of the data and the publication of all the results. A graduate student working on such an experiment typically gets to know just one of the many pieces of the apparatus involved. After collecting the data, the various groups in the collaboration typically divvy it up for analysis at their home institutions. Graduate students usually analyze some part of the work for their degrees. Whether the graduate student has worked in a large group or alone, when at long last he completes what he understood to be the agreed-upon work, typically he is dismayed to find that his advisor sees things differently. The advisor never seems to stop asking for another measurement or another calculation. When the advisor finally relents, the student writes a lengthy description of his research, the dissertation. He gives a talk and answers questions about his work before a small audience at a defense of dissertation ritual, and then receives the PhD degree. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Right now, I'm reading from Chapter 8, which is titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Going on to the next subsection titled Disillusionment. Are we having fun yet? This would be a cruel question to ask graduate students during the research phase of their training. It would rub in the fact that the temporary compromises they made to get past the qualifying examination are still very much in effect and are going to remain so at least until the end of graduate school, which may be years away. This predicament, and the way the student gets into it, was the subject of an insightful satirical article published anonymously during the Vietnam War. The article appeared in a truly underground newspaper. The Physics Free Press was a short-lived tell-it-like-it-is publication, produced secretly and distributed nationally by graduate students and postdoctoral research fellows who had to remain anonymous for their own protection. The article, apparently written by a solid-state physicist, is part of a response to the shortage of physics jobs at the time. However, it is mainly a response to a training system in which students expecting to do exciting, important work find themselves instead confined to narrow technical problems that have been detached from the larger goals that engender them, or worse, that are situated in a socially reactionary context, such as that of the military or the powerful corporations. Here is the article in its entirety. Steps to Disillusion a Young Physicist. As you walk into Dr. Fartsworth's office, you timidly wonder, why would the world's distinguished expert on low-temperature thermal conductivity of doped CAF ever agree to take me as a graduate research assistant? Me, with my B+ in solid state, and him, with his Natural Academy of Science membership, consultantship with ITT, 150 published works, and well-chewed pipe. I was in his course, but I wonder if he ever saw me. Step 2. As he puffs pipe smoke in your face, he tells you his research group is large, but yes, he can take on one more student in the fall. He gives you a stack of his most recent works for you to read. You're in the group. Step 3. Let's see, what are Fartsworth's articles? Refinement of Paracer-Par-Popal Calculations on Pseudomedium Crystals. Low-temperature thermal conductivity of lanthanum fluoride's deviation from Debye approximation. Splitting of metastable 4F5D excited configuration in crystalline GD-CAF2 at low temperatures. A twinge of boredom and frustration touches down, but you chase it away with the thought you are reading real science. Paracer-Par-Popal methods apply to GD-doped CAF2. Does Fartsworth really like this, SHIT? Step 4. Well, there you are, fixing the leak in the vacuum system which insulates the liquid helium, which cools the neodymium strontium chloride crystal, which needs to have a splitting in its absorption spectrum looked at for some reason. Step number 5. Fartsworth gets the funds to take you to the Gordon Solid State Conference in Boulder, Colorado. He invites you, you say, yes, as you think, wow. Near the Rockies. I can get in some hiking. Apparently, Fartsworth wants to keep up with new developments in calcium fluoride. Sure he does, right? Step number 6. The lobby and conference rooms of the Boulder Hilton are filled with well-dressed Dr. Fartsworths from all over the country. A debutante's ball of physicists. A veritable mutual admiration society for the peacocks of physics, all circulating from clump to clump, talking and building their reputations. Step number 7. Fartsworth advises you, don't talk about your neodymium experiment with Jim Weiss over there. He's in the same field. Gee, I hope his vacuum system is busted too, or he'll publish first. You think, it's okay, you talk to Jim Weiss about the weather in Colorado, and he slyly doesn't mention neodymium either. Hey, there's Stan, one of Fartsworth's former students. Hiya, Stan, what you doing here? Stan looks grim. He tells you how he can't find a job after 2 years as a postdoc, so now he's scavenging around the big shots in the lobby hoping to discover a tentative job offer. He can't talk long because there are hundreds of young physicists around the lobby looking for the same dough, and he must resume the hunt. Step 8. The travel grant paid for the plane fare and hotel for this conference. $815. Enough to pay a postdoc 1 month. But now Fartsworth is using it up in his 10-minute talk on lanthanum-doped CAF2. That's 8150 per minute. You think, is 10 minutes nearly long enough to summarize 2 years of research? Or maybe it's 10 minutes too long. But you learn fast in those 10 minutes. Fartsworth's goal is to glibly mention ideas it took both of you 2 months to fully grasp, to be both confusing and smooth, bored and witty, and above all, to impress. And the audience is impressed. A few wise guys make attempts to steal away the victory with irrelevant and puzzling questions, but Fartsworth can handle them. He's a real pro. Everyone is properly bamboozled, and Fartsworth is smiling. 10 minutes later, after the next talk, no one in the room remembers anything about lathidem-doped CAF2, but they do remember Dr. Fartsworth. Mission accomplished. Step number 9. You finally complete your first paper. But even its appearance in a highly respected and thick biweekly journal sandwiched between 2 other equally dull and opaque articles fails to alleviate your growing boredom and disillusionment with a career in physics, a career that once seemed to promise excitement, glamour, and importance. Are you going to spend your whole life in a mad, cutthroat ego trip just to see your name in print every 6 months? Or is the real pleasure in seeing your name referenced in someone else's useless article? Step number 10. The Morning Tribune headline grabs your throat. Campus anti-war crazies invade computer center. Bastards. They sure have balls, though. Don't they have any respect for anything? Maybe they're not so crazy. Those punks screwed up some professors' military contracted programs. Far trucking out. You don't like violence, but the computer takeover looks more relevant to you than anything that sat on your lab bench for the last 2 years. Step number 11. The university faculty meeting is discussing how to preserve its academic chastity in the face of the computer's rape by anti-war demonstrators and other crazy hoods. One professor, highly respected for his public spiritedness, as indicated by his association with the Institute for Defense Analysis and Defense-Related Problems, sobs that 2 years of his work on simulated bombing missions has been destroyed by anti-war violence. A poli-sci professor indignantly declares that his files on elites and leadership in anti-communist Cambodians, prepared for the State Department, have been stolen and published in a local underground newspaper, a clear violation of his academic freedom. Then Professor Fartsworth gets up to denounce the freaks, saying that computers and electronics are the greatest advance for civilization since the TV, and therefore to attack a computer is an uncivilized act. Of course, he doesn't mention the untold advantages of electronic, computerized warfare to the civilians of Vietnam. The professors are now finished farting in unison against the threat to their collective existence and return to their offices to individually resume slitting each other's professional throats, perhaps to emerge again if their academic freedom is again touched by the turmoil of the real world. Step number 12. By now, your irrelevant research project, the ego-based seminars and conferences, the race to publish, the social hypocrisy of your professors, all these are bringing you to unexpected conclusions about the world of physics. It is a world full of corrupting contradictions, just like any other big business. Mutual cooperation is only a route to personal advancement. Communication is meant to confuse. Progress is measured in published papers per year, quantitatively, just like GNP, and just like the economy. Big physics thrives via hypocrisy, competition, deception, waste, and irrelevancy. The startling similarity between big physics and private big business is no accident either. Consultantships, research for industry, and technological aids to imperialist wars all put physics in the service of big business, sometimes directly, but often indirectly through the government. Both physics and business are based on the every-man-for-himself principle. Although there are a few winners, the Seaborgs and Tellers in physics and the DuPonts and Rockefellers in business, most everyone else loses through disillusionment, mental anguish, and the threat, now real, of imminent unemployment. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. And I'm reading from Chapter 8, which is titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum, in which he's describing the steps in graduate school by which the young students' ideals are broken to the yoke of corporate service. And going on to the final subsection, employment. The student who by some malfunction of the system graduates without having gotten used to performing disciplined labor on assigned problems, that is, the student who has not developed an assignable curiosity and has not accommodated to being a top flunky in someone's hierarchy, even this student is not home free. As he seeks career work, it becomes clear that although he may remember his original goals, he is not trained to pursue them, having spent his time working in the prescribed direction, maintaining the prescribed attitude. However, his demonstrated ability to do disciplined intellectual work in his field upon command, to temporarily, quote-unquote, suspend his prerogative to shape the world in his own way through his intellectual work, and to perform alienated intellectual labor, this skill, however it is phrased, and no matter how much he dislikes exercising it, is valuable in the marketplace. Thus, he soon finds himself employed, doing work all too familiar, work similar to what he previously accepted only because it was to be temporary, only to get the degree. This is not to say that even the product of a malfunctioning training system is doomed to work as a complete ideological servant of the very status quo he wants to change. He can remain a force for change, but only by joining with like-minded professionals and non-professionals to act on issues involving the content of his work. When the professional training system does not malfunction, it selects and produces people who are comfortable surrendering political control over their work, people who are not deeply troubled by the status quo, and who are willing and able to do work that supports it. Nevertheless, some jobs subject the graduates to further scrutiny and conditioning. For example, in a university job, which must lead either to tenure or dismissal, the graduate finds himself in a new multi-year qualification struggle, with all the attendant conservatizing effects. To qualify for tenure, the assistant professor must get as much published as possible, and so he pursues the work that he knows best, topics closely related to his dissertation, and he does this work in the way most likely to meet the approval of journal referees, namely, conservatively, being careful not to raise any controversy. Whether the young professional has surrendered political control through the normal process of qualification, or by somehow slipping through the qualification system but then failing to conspire with like-minded people, he turns his effort toward achieving along more traditional lines. Thus, the yuppie finds himself running in the conventional rat race. He follows the course of this race obediently and aggressively with all his energy. He measures his progress quantitatively now, in tender valued through the system. Bucks pulled down, possessions accumulated, position attained. Scientists are no less likely than other professionals to follow this course. The university scientist gets recognition, status, promotions, and raises by publishing papers. The industrial scientist keeps score by publishing papers and also by getting patents. Thus, the scientist whose bottom line is defined by the market is likely to view a research project in terms of the papers or patents that can be mined from it. There must be many such scientists, as scientific journals are filled with papers on narrow topics of little interest that have obviously been published more to advance careers than to advance knowledge. Nothing reveals more clearly the degree to which employed professionals are alienated from their subjects than does the sharply contrasting behavior of the hobbyists or buffs in their fields. When hobbyists encounter one another at social gatherings, before long you find them talking eagerly about the content of their subject of common interest, showing an excitement, enthusiasm, wonder, and curiosity that is reminiscent of beginning professional students. This rarely happens when professionals talk casually with their colleagues, unlike the amateurs. The professionals don't talk much about the work itself. They often appear detached from their subject, as if they don't derive much satisfaction from it. Yes, they talk shop, but their focus is so far from the content of the work itself that you would have a hard time if you had to guess what kind of shop they worked in. A commercial bank? A junior high school? A government agency? A university department? Casual conversation among professionals tends to focus on the actions and personalities of employers and powerful figures within their fields, the standard gossip topics of the powerless. The gossip is by no means idle, however, for the politics are central to their work as professionals. Thus, at the wine and cheese reception after an English department colloquium, a first-year graduate student musters the courage to approach the speaker, a well-known professor from another university, and ask a question about literature. But before the conversation has gotten very far, a local faculty member walks up and derails it with a question he has been waiting to ask. "Is Jones really planning to leave Yale? I heard a rumor." Soon the two professors are engrossed in a wide-ranging discussion about job openings around the country, research grants, book contracts, journal editors, and who's jockeying for power in the field. The graduate student, realizing that the conversation is not going to return to the evidently less important topic of literature, retreats back into the crowd. Versions of this generic scene occur frequently in every field. The professors here symbolize the tragedy of all employed professionals who started out as students loving their subjects. Such students submit themselves to the process of professional training in an effort to be free of the marketplace. But instead of being strengthened by the process, they are crippled by it. Deprived of political control over their own work, they become alienated from their subjects and measure their lives by success in the marketplace. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 8, titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum, from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. Jeff Schmidt received his Ph.D. in physics from the University of California and worked for 19 years as a writer and editor of Physics Today. He was fired after publishing this book. For more information on the book and its author, visit DisciplinedMinds.com. And to hear previous unwelcome guest shows you've missed or to contact us, visit unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.